From KPFK in Los Angeles, California, Valley Free Radio in Florence, and WMBR in Cambridge, Massachusetts, WNUC in Detroit, and BikeTalk.org worldwide, this is Bike Talk.
Bike Talk.
Welcome to Bike Talk. I'm Taylor Nichols.
I'm Nick Richard.
Nick, where's Anne-Marie Drolet?
Oh, yeah, she's at a meeting.
Yeah, she said that she was at a union meeting for BTS, I believe, the Bicycle Transit System organization that she works for. That's Fighting Lyft, and that was on the show last week.
Yeah, so it's ongoing. It continues.
It continues. The fight continues. Push that rock up the hill.
Fighting off Lyft.
Fighting off everybody, all the NIMBYs.
Are the NIMBYs on them too?
No, but the NIMBYs are everywhere. Dang it. Did I just say, dang it? God darn it.
Hey, congratulations on your street, Willoughby.
Thank you very much. You know, this is something that we've been talking about on the show. There's a east-west street through West Hollywood, right where I live. And we've been fighting for a long time to remove the cut-through traffic and to make the neighborhood safer. And finally, the city of West Hollywood voted 3-2. It was a close vote to support some safe street measures in our neighborhood. It wasn't a total win. We didn't get the traffic diverters that we thought would really stop the cut-through traffic, but we got some chicanes and some ballabouts and some roundabouts. But we have Miriam Pinsky here, Nick, and Miriam's been on the show in the past. She's a research PhD on transportation at the Shared Use Mobility Center in Los Angeles. And Miriam, you've written a lot about how cities do outreach for these kinds of projects. Welcome back to Bike Talk.
Thanks so much for having me. Yes, Willoughby, I haven't specifically written about, but I have privately ranted about it and I suppose publicly on your podcast. So I'm always happy to talk about the woes of community engagement when it comes to bike lanes. So happy to be here.
Well, you know, last week on the show, we had Adam Rogers and he wrote a long article about how bike lanes are good for business. Willoughby has been in the works for 5 years. What's taken so long?
That's a great question. So unlike maybe some other public infrastructure projects like a sewer, we really require quite a bit of community engagement to get these pilot projects off the ground. So again, luckily, this is no longer a pilot project, but to get to where it is, it had to be one. That was right. Part of what added so much delay. And the funny thing is that, you know, ultimately, after many years now of studies around what this project will do, huge amounts of money, this is essentially a giant grift to the consultant world.
Right.
And lots of angry meetings and negative feedback, we end up with basically a watered down version of about a mile of a slower street.
Right.
And I say that because there's not even, we couldn't even get at any kind of protected infrastructure in terms of a bike lane for what is really one of the very few designated bike corridors in Los Angeles. So in a nutshell, I think we just had a lot of space for people to get riled up about a project that ultimately came through, but like was watered down. So
right.
No one should worry about losing their parking spot at the end
right.
of the day.
Right.
Miriam, you mentioned a sewer. You said it's compared it to a sewer. And I think that there's probably more to that analogy than it maybe is immediately apparent. You want to unpack that?
When there's a sewage emergency, we don't schedule a public meeting to get everyone to talk about what the best way is for us to address that. We just hope that the professionals can manage it. We have a major public safety hazard problem. People are dying and getting injured on our streets. And yet we still decide that instead of just putting in the infrastructure that study after study shows works, we're going to go through this huge process of testing. Yeah, just the very idea that we need a pilot project to see what is going to make people safer, I think, is a problem. And clearly, it's also not really getting neighbors on board. At the end of the day, people were still pretty negative about it.
Right. But, yeah. All they care about is, are you taking away any parking spots at all? And like you said, it's a mile stretch. And we're talking just about Willoughby here, but this is the same case that is going on all across the country every time anybody wants to put in any kind of safe street infrastructure, bike lane or whatever. And that makes me think of 72nd Street in New York, Nick. Is that what you're pointing at me for?
Yeah, we have Carl Mahoney of Streetstopia Upper West Side, the blog, and also Open Plans. And Carl is reimagining, not alone, 72nd Street in Manhattan.
Nice to join you guys again. Yeah, it's so interesting to hear about this public engagement process in Los Angeles. I'm curious how formalized that process is, Miriam, that you just sort of laid out.
I mean, it was all like every meeting was had to be designated ahead of time. This was a joint effort too with the city of LA and the city of West Hollywood. So you have multiple agencies working on this, many consultant groups also working on this. And then just in terms of who ends up showing up, that's pretty organized too. Got some very organized community groups involved in opposing these things. So,
well, I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And Carl, I'll be curious what's going on in New York with 72nd Street, because that's such a major east-west. It connects Central Park to, I think, Riverside Park, correct?
It does indeed. And that's one of the, I think one of the sort of emotional hooks of the reimagining. It's such a natural connection for people on bikes and other micromobility devices, and just for people strolling. You get a lot of tourists who come to the Upper West Side, who come to both of those parks. And it's especially challenging for people on bikes. You've got Central Park, you know, it's a roughly six mile loop that goes the length of the park from 59th to 110th. And then on the west side in Riverside Park, you've got the Hudson River Greenway. And these are two of the most heavily used greenways in the country. And there is nothing connecting them. They're about a half a mile, maybe three quarters of a mile from each other, and no way to connect them. And that's just, I mean, that's just absurd.
It's stupid.
I think that's an accurate word for it. And so this project on 72nd Street really started, I would say, you know, probably 5-6 years ago in earnest, as a bike connecting project. It just makes so much sense. In 2020, I think it was, maybe September 2020, Community Board 7, which is the Upper West Side, passed a resolution asking for the Department of Transportation to study a two-way protected bike lane connecting Riverside Park and Central Park, along with pedestrian safety improvements and other and some accommodations for deliveries. So from that resolution, nothing has happened. That's the sort of like awkwardness of this process. It's not a super formal process. A community board puts a resolution out there, a formal letter is sent to the DOT, and the DOT can do what they want with it or not.
Well, when Jeanette Sadik Khan was in New York, things moved pretty fast. What's slowing it down now? Is there neighbor backlash to it or bikelash to it or what?
I think it's a lot of things. Who is in the mayor's office and appoints those agency heads has a lot of say over what gets done. There's been a lot written about our current mayor, Eric Adams, right, who has slow walked a lot of projects and even pulled back on some projects. Like, very obvious safety improvements, necessary safety improvements that have just been killed because of, in these cases, influential, you know, some cases donors who made a stink.
Under the current plan, will you have to take away any parking or not?
you can't improve a city without taking away parking.
Right. I think that's just... excellent answer. That's a great answer. also one more thing, Carl, that's above the 60th Street congestion pricing zone, correct?
It is indeed. It is indeed. You touched on the hot button on the Upper West Side these days, which is what will happen when congestion pricing goes into effect. There's a lot of fear that the Upper West Side will turn into a parking lot, that people will drive in from Westchester and search for parking 15, 20 minutes, and then find something and then hop out of their car and take the train the rest of the way. I think somebody will try that once.
And that will be the
last time. And the MTA's own projections say that that's just really unlikely to happen.
Right.
In fact, your local son, Donald Shoup, showed up to the CB7 Community Board last week and spoke on this very issue. And so far, the reaction has been really quite enthusiastic, both from the public and the local block association and elected officials that we've talked to.
You have a artist's rendering you want to direct listeners to where that is?
Yeah. If you go to our website, streetopia.city, it's on our campaign page, Reimagining the Upper West Side, or Reimagine West 72nd Street, sorry. And the link is / reimagining-W72.
Great. So really, whether it's in New York or LA, it's the same thing all the time, right, Nick? I mean, we have to fight for every inch of safe street space.
Yeah. And so what's the strategy here? I mean, we were not completely satisfied with Willoughby. And any tips, Taylor and Miriam, for Carl?
Just because I've been, you know, nodding in agreement and in joint frustration with our other guest here, I think it's really hard to win over people who never get on a bike themselves. I'm not sure how much we can count on community engagement to get people to be sympathetic. That's kind of the downer version. I do think some of the things happening, though, overall, big picture, take a step back, are really positive. Thinking about, for example, the congestion pricing. I mean, LA is also looking at that. I think generally pricing driving, that's going to be a great way to get people to think twice about how they get around,
right,
in the best way, and might actually get them on bikes. Who knows? I think the second part is, like, you know, we have more kind of streamlined improvements. That's huge. We have in LA, for example, the Healthy Streets LA measure that got passed, which basically would, with any kind of street repaving, incorporate the already approved, in a different mobility plan, things we should anyway be doing, but kind of force the hand of the city to automatically incorporate bike ped transit improvements along with car improvements.
Right.
So those are kind of big picture, I think, general positive things. So I don't want to be too down on all of this, because I think by automating some of this stuff, once we're like, okay, we just spent 5 years dragging our feet on some pilot projects, maybe we can say, let's, you know, the lessons we learned here apply elsewhere. That would be my
right.
silver lining from all
the
time. Well,
it worries me, because one of the lessons that I've learned over the years is half measures don't work. There's a certain point where you just got to go all in, and we're going to say, we're going to make this a safe street, and we're going to dissuade, cut through traffic, and we're going to make it safe for children. And there might be a steep learning curve to that, but it ultimately pays off, as Adam Rogers again last week proved in his article, bike lanes are good for business.
That's exactly what we are, why we took the approach that we did with West 72nd Street. It's a vision that is bolder than what I think the Department of Transportation plan would have been had they responded to the community board in a timely fashion. It shows people what's possible. And it's so much more than bike infrastructure. That's just one part of it. We're really prioritizing, we're reprioritizing the street from now what is 80, from curb to curb, 88% of that street space, when you figure in traffic lanes and parking for these four blocks, 88% of that street space is given over to motor vehicles. I think there's no space for bikes at all. And the sidewalks are what they are, and they're all the stuff gets dumped on the sidewalks, your street signs, your fire hydrants, your bike parking, your
right,
all of that
your
stuff.
Trash.
New York City, right? So we really thought of this as something that would benefit everyone, whether you're a person who gets around by walking or using mobility device, whether you're a kid, whether you're an older person, whether you are an experienced cyclist, whether you're a delivery cyclist, whether you're a person who's driving, whether you're somebody who's, you know, delivering boxes for Amazon. The idea is that if we reallocate the space on this street to serve everybody, everybody wins.
Right. Well, the world is better for everybody when more people ride bikes. Carl from New York, Miriam from Los Angeles, thanks for keeping pushing the rock up the hill, and thanks for coming on Bike Talk.
Thank you. This was a nice opportunity to talk.
It was my pleasure. Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
So the whole point of having Miriam and Carl on the show was that what they are fighting for, what we're all fighting for, is safe streets. And we've been getting some feedback about what kind of responsibility cyclists and pedestrians have to keep safe and to make the streets safe that they walk and bike on.
I have pushed back on emphasis on how people on bikes and walking can be safer by dressing in bright colors, or if you're walking, not wearing headphones or biking. One of our discussions was about high-vis. I think it was a funny tweet. A driver crashed into the produce section of a Whole Foods, even though the fruits were all wearing bright colors.
Yeah, bright oranges and bright reds for the strawberries, right. Well, we got an email recently from Dan Murphy, who's in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, Dan is actually the city engineer for the city of East Hampton, Massachusetts. And he's been on the show. It was a bike talk episode called Main Streets, which you can search. And he wrote, "Hi, I think your on-air criticisms of those who recommend use of high-vis/reflectors is misplaced. Even Norway currently recommends use of high-vis/reflectors in their Vision Zero program, probably the best one in the world. See page 29 of their plan. It's the National Plan of Action for Road Safety for Norway. They encourage its use. As they know, it's one cost-effective way to save lives, and study backs its use up. It's not victim blaming. It's using all tools in the toolbox with the limited tax dollars to save lives. You can go on about highway widenings in places that are growing, but we live in a 50-state country where the priorities will be different in some states, especially quickly growing ones with fast-rising VMT. Hopefully one day high-vis and reflectors will not be needed there or here, but until that day comes, it should be encouraged and not mocked, especially here, as we're at least a decade behind Norway in the effort to make our roads safer for people walking and biking." Dan Murphy, and that's a city engineer of the city of East Hampton, Massachusetts.
So what's your feedback on that?
Well, I was not mocking high-vis. I try to be as visible as possible with lights. And, you know, if I had a high-vis thing I would wear, but I wear a reflective vest. But to tell people on bikes that the way that they need to be safer is to take responsibility and wear high-vis, it can be victim blaming. It's implying that that's where the onus is for safety, is on the most vulnerable person on the road. We wouldn't need all this if it wasn't for cars, if it wasn't for unsafe streets.
Right.
And in the plan that Dan linked to in Norway, it was on page 29, after distracted driving, intoxicated driving, and speeding. And so, yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about high-vis in context, you know, not as the only thing you say, like when the police chief of Los Angeles said the reason for record high traffic fatalities was people on bikes not being in bike lanes and reckless pedestrians.
This last year saw an increase in cyclists and pedestrian deaths, for instance. Many times it's their involvement of walking outside of a crosswalk or perhaps on a roadway that doesn't have a designated bicycle lane, not wearing reflective gear and so forth, that results in these tragedies. So it's a collective effort, it's a shared effort.
Right.
And that was it.
He didn't mention speeding cars or drivers who text at all. But when you ride at night, what do you wear?
A reflective vest, and I have lights, and I'll use all the high vis I can personally. Then you're going to tell a person on a bike who probably knows they have to be seen. And if it's a PSA from your local Department of Transportation or your State Department of Transportation, tell the drivers first.
Right. You know, Jim Pokras has been on the show, and he's talked about what the legal requirements are for the bike: a front light, a back light, a side reflector. That's certainly what I have. I do wear high vis sometimes, but not all the time. And I think what Dan is saying is that ultimately everyone has to make their own decisions and wear what makes them feel safe. But you even said earlier that sometimes high vis even attracts drivers. You said there's a study that said when you're lit up like a Christmas tree, it's kind of like a moth to flame with a speeding car.
I'm not standing behind that statement. I think I remember reading that somewhere. I'm not sure where.
Right.
But sure, if that's what Dan's saying, that everybody should do what they feel makes them safer, then I agree with that.
Yeah. I think there's room to mock the whole situation a little bit, though, because I love that tweet about the car in Whole Foods, you know, ramming into the produce section, even though the oranges were orange and the lemons were yellow.
Yeah, right. But we know some people don't think that this is a situation we should make light of.
Right. Well, you know, our first interview, Nick, is about an environment where you don't need to wear high vis. It's about biking on rails to trails. There's a program called the Great American Rail Trail, and we're going to interview some people that are responsible for that and fighting to complete that, where you could ride all the way across the United States on a separated, segregated bike trail.
Cool.
The number one reason people give for not riding their bikes more is they don't feel safe. Bike lanes are so important. They allow people to feel safe from cars for a few blocks or getting to work or the store. But bike trails are a game changer. Last week, we talked about the 66 Parallel Trail in Washington that takes you 18 miles right into downtown Washington, D.C. to see some of the monuments. We've talked on the show about the Tart Trail in northern Michigan that goes 30 or 40 miles in the Leelanau Peninsula. There's also the Katy Trail that goes 240 miles across Missouri. But soon, there's going to be the Great American Rail Trail, and you can go all the way across the country on a dedicated, protected bike trail. And today we have Amanda Cooley is the planning director of the Powell County Planning Commission, and Kevin Bell is the project director of the Great American Rail Trail for Rails to Trails Conservancy. Kevin and Amanda, welcome to Bike Talk. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Taylor.
Thanks, Taylor. Great to be here.
Yeah. Kevin, tell us a little bit about this Great American Rail Trail. Does it really go from Washington, D.C. to Washington State?
It sure will. Yeah. So right now, it's already about 55% complete across the country, meaning that you could get on to trails anywhere between Washington, D.C. and Washington State, and you could bike, walk, horseback ride, various multimodal forms of transportation on over 2,000 miles of trails that exist today. And that goes across 12 states and D.C. It's the flagship project of Rails to Trails Conservancy, and we're actually celebrating the fifth anniversary of the launch of this project coming up next month in May.
All right. Well, maybe we should back up a little bit. Can you tell us a little bit about what Rails to Trails are?
Yeah, Rails to Trails Conservancy has been around since the mid-80s, but the idea is even older than that. And it was born out of the times when the railroads were becoming abandoned. And a lot of them went through towns, much like Deer Lodge in Montana that Amanda represents, that the railroad, when they no longer were in service, you had these dedicated corridors that were flat because railroads could only go at a certain grade, and they're pretty wide and they go through towns. And that makes perfect trails because you can have the most amount of people use them. So Rails to Trails was founded to help build this around the country. And now we have tens of thousands of miles of multi-use trail corridors, many of which are on old railroad lines today around the country.
Wow. It just sounds fabulous. Amanda, maybe you could tell us from your side, because you work for government, correct? What are the benefits and what are the obstacles to building more trails?
Yeah, definitely. I do work for a county government. And so I kind of operate from that lens, which sometimes makes things move a little bit slower. There's a lot more process. And so sometimes it's a little bit slower to work at the government level, but you can also make big things happen because you have more capacity, more access to resources. Right. And so with the recent influx of federal funding, we've been able to capitalize on that and also capitalize on the momentum of the Great American Rail Trail to put a tiny town like ours on the map, put it back on the map. It was on the map when the railroad was coming through. And once that went away, the town kind of died with it. And so the opportunity to transition these rail beds into an active transportation corridor is a great benefit to us. It is a challenge, especially in the West. Before we started this conversation, Kevin mentioned that it's a unique situation out here in the West. And that's for a few different reasons. Part of it is because it's a landowner rights first state in Montana. And I think you see that in Wyoming too. And so there's some demand for active transportation, but it's not as concentrated as you see in the urban areas. So trying to mobilize enough public sentiment to really push these projects forward is one challenge, even though there is actually a pretty broad base of support. And so to be able to do that, though, working in this rural space, to be able to actually achieve this idea of getting a national trail system in, our strategy has actually been to create a regional partnership.
One of the things we often hear about bike lanes is, you know, the people who live near a bike lane is, oh, we don't want a bike lane. Those bikers in their spandex, they'll steal my garden gnome or something like that. And that doesn't usually turn out to be the case, does it?
Definitely.
No.
I think just around the country, we see that sentiment come up a lot. And there's no data that shows that trails bring in folks who have nefarious purposes.
Right.
And in fact, trails, especially trails that are busy and active, it creates safety because you've got more people out there. So the trail itself is safer and there's more eyes in the region and on the neighborhood.
Right. Is there any data that proves that bike trails are good for business?
Absolutely. They are great for business. We work with trail towns all across the country that when you build a trail through town and you have the resources that say, hey, go a few blocks this way and you can get to the ice cream shop or there's the bike store down the street, the restaurants, etc. That is huge. And we know that trails have an incredible impact on towns, especially small towns. Railroads, as Amanda said, used to go through a lot of these small towns. What we're trying to do with these trails is build up diversifying local economies. Trail tourism is a booming industry, especially since COVID. We know right. People want to be outside on trails.
Yeah, I've done that a couple of times with some buddies. I meet in a place and we ride on the trail for, you know, 3 or 4 days. And hotels too.
Yeah, lodging is definitely an important thing. And especially as you think about a long distance trip like one might take on the Great American Rail Trail. We're hoping that this continues to spark entrepreneurship in some of these small towns that may not have a hotel, but may see, oh, there are people who are interested in doing these long distance trips who need a place to stay and they want to spend money. We know right. People who go on these trips often will have expendable money to put in these towns and give them a reason to spend it in your town.
And they need to eat. Bikers need to eat.
A lot. We need to eat a lot. Yes.
Well, it sounds like people sometimes just don't understand the importance of the rails to trails. These are all defunct train lines, right? And that's why they're different trails, because they were different train lines and you're connecting them all together.
It's largely connecting former rail lines turned into trails, though many of them are not, including, for instance, like the C&O Canal in my backyard here in Maryland that follows a canal. It's not an old rail corridor, but it has a similar feel. And that's what we're trying to create across the country. It's not going to be able to be one continuous old rail corridor. That just doesn't exist.
Right.
But we've got to get creative, especially in places like Wyoming and Montana that did not have that fabric of rail corridors. And many of the rail corridors that existed out there are still active today. And we're not here to try to say that rail lines should abandon. Rail infrastructure is very important. So we've got to get creative about other opportunities like building trails alongside active rail lines,
right.
Building trails within the wide rights of way of county and state highways that exist out west, and other solutions that we're still working on.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a quick comment. I mean, I'm a planner, and so the trails are going to vary because there's different geographies, different communities, different challenges. And so, you know, the reason it's not just like one continuous single highway line is because it ties into our communities and our individual trail systems.
Right. I mean, actually, after hearing you all talk, it makes me think that that's what makes the trail even more richer, because it is not just a super highway. It's a blue highway that sort of takes you, like you said, into towns.
That is exactly the draw. Yeah, that is exactly the draw. And so when you come through a place like Deer Lodge, you are coming through a historic main street. You're going to ride your bike right by the old Montana State Prison. You'll be along a scenic river. You know, for us, that's what you'll experience. And that's going to wind through our community and wind through that path. What you might see back east is going to be something completely different. And that is the treasure, is you really get to experience the character and the place instead of just kind of flying by like, oh, that was some cool scenery.
Totally. Is the trail paved? Is it different in different places, I guess?
Yeah, all of the above. Many of the trails are paved, many are not. I mean, I've gotten to enjoy the Great Allegheny Passage, which is a trail along our route between Pittsburgh and Cumberland, Maryland. That's not a paved trail, but it's one of the best trails I've ever been on because the surface is so well maintained and so well traveled that we don't need to be paved everywhere, but many, many trails, especially through urban areas on the trail are.
Right.
If you're going on a full cross-country trip, I would definitely recommend a gravel bike that because some of the trails themselves are not, you're not, it's not the smooth experience that you're going to get on every single trail. And that's part of the fun, right, as well, right?
Sure.
The old Yellowstone Trail, I've walked on it with Amanda. It's great. I'm probably not taking my road bike on that trail. And that's okay. That's not the experience, right, that we're trying to provide across the entire country.
Right, right. Well, I know that when I often ride on like crushed limestone trails, they're almost smoother than paved trails. You know, they're a little bit softer and fun to ride on. I really enjoy it.
Yeah, it's great. You get a little dusty sometimes, and that's part of the fun too, right? And I want to feel like I'm outside.
Right. How much of this has to do with the money from the Biden administration?
Yeah, we are in an unprecedented time for the amount of funding available for trails, walking, and biking. But we just launched a program with the Active Transportation Infrastructure Investment Program. This was just created through that bipartisan infrastructure law. And these are the big dollar projects specifically for trails, creating networks. There are over 150 developing trail networks around the country. The Great American Rail Trail is one of those pieces.
Right.
But this is a dedicated pot of money just specifically for trails and these big pictures, so they don't have to compete against highway projects. So yeah, the only problem with that program is it was appropriated only at $45 million, and they had the ability to appropriate it at over $200 million. And we need to have a lot of applications in for this cycle to prove that need. So applications are due June 17th. And you can go to railstotrails.org/funding to learn more if you've got a big project in your community you want to work on.
That's exactly what I want to get to, is how do people help you expand the trail? Amanda, from your vantage point, are you asking for money? Are you getting money?
Well, we're definitely asking for it. And, you know, you asked if the funding that was made available in the infrastructure bill was making a difference. And for us, it is the reason that our partnership was galvanized. And so what we've done is we have actually partnered with a 6-county region across Western Montana. So it's found about 260 linear miles across 6 counties. And we have used these funding opportunities to bring a partnership together to actually be able to take kind of our siloed rural individual efforts and actually look at taking a chunk out of what would need to happen in Western Montana. And so last year in 2023, and then also this year, we did apply for the RAISE grant program. Mm-hmm. And that would pay for us to do a feasibility study to look at what and how we would connect all of our communities. So we would be able to realize the benefits within our communities through this funding, but also be able to achieve kind of this larger, big goal of trying to get some good trail mileage in through Montana. Wow. Because Montana and Wyoming definitely have the largest gaps. We have the farthest way to go. And it's really only going to be funding opportunities that are going to help rural places like us to be able to have enough capacity and to be able to have the funding to get this done.
Well, we know that bike lanes are like chains and they're only as strong as their weakest link. So if you're on a bike lane and all of a sudden the bike lane ends and you're in a busy intersection, novice or less experienced bike riders are going to ride on those bike lanes. And I think the same thing sounds like it's true also for these bike trails, that if you're on this beautiful trail, but then you're dropped off and you have to ride 5-10 miles on a busy road, you're going to stop your trip and not continue on to another town, it sounds like.
This is a huge challenge for us. We see a lot of the bikers that come through. We still get a lot of bike traffic. We're also on the Continental Divide, so we get a lot of that. And they are stuck riding on interstate. We still have a lot of people that come through that aren't necessarily experienced, but it does definitely create dangerous situations. You know, narrow bridges, interstate traffic, you know, right next to you as you're right. traveling.
Yeah, the route of the Great American Rail Trail east of the Mississippi is almost 75-80% complete. So you can go on long 100, 200, 300 mile sections without ever going on a road. We're trying to get the West to catch up to that because right. there's so much to offer there, but the trails are spaced far apart. So you're exactly right. It limits the amount of people who are doing long trips. But I do want to say that these trails that go through a town like Deer Lodge are so important to the community that they exist in. This trail is not only for the long distance person coming from far away who wants to check this bucket list off their list. This is something that is used by people every day for their morning walks, to teach their kids how to ride bikes, to take the dog out. And that's really important to highlight too.
Yeah, that is such an important point. So again, to the idea that these trails are highlighting our communities, you know, we still, even having approximately 10 miles of trail in Deer Lodge, we still have a great regional draw. We get people from about a 3-hour radius that will come visit, spend money in our community. And we definitely see that push during the summer months when tourism is higher, bike traffic is higher. And Kevin's so right that one of the critical benefits of this, it's really neat and it's really great to try and construct this coast-to-coast trail, but especially in a rural community, it really is transformational. It creates sidewalks where there wasn't sidewalks, so that, you know, betters ADA accessibility. It enables access to our downtown businesses. Absolutely. It makes the communities more safe. For us, it will actually create a safe route to school. It will tie the community back together after it was split in half by an interstate. So where one trailhead ends and another one begins, it's going to go right through town through our historic Main Street, and it will actually connect the east and west sides of town. And so one of the reasons that we're pushing this so hard is because this, I mean, it's all the things that we know that trails provide, but really, really at the ground level is providing outdoor access. You've got the mental and the physical health benefits to the communities. Right. And so we're really focused on the fact that there's just this great community benefit for our citizens, as well as creating this additional ability for visitors to be able to have a great experience.
Yeah, really, it just sounds like a win-win situation, you know, for both locals and tourists. I just love 100%. It. Kevin, what's the timeline? I mean, if it's 55% finished now, you said, is that correct? What's the timeline for being 100% and maybe being the first person to go all the way across the country on the Rails to Trails trail?
Yeah, we're lucky that people are already going out and doing it now before it's complete. We have a group of veterans every year through warrior expeditions that used to go on the highways across the country, and it was a little stressful for them. So when they found out about this 5 years ago, they reached out and said, hey, we want to follow your route, even though it's not done. So they come through every year, which is great. We're looking at a few decades for full completion, but every year there's new miles that come on board. There's new multi-million dollar grant funds that come in to help right. make this progress. So we've got lots of ways to show the momentum and progress that right. is continuing to happen.
Got a few decades. That just kills me that we're not able to move faster for some of this stuff. It just seems like such a great idea. How do people find out more about the Great American Rail Trail and Rails to Trails anyways? And how might they be able to plan a short trip if they're within, you know, a couple hours drive from one of the trails?
Absolutely. Yeah. Go to railstotrails.org/Great American Rail Trail, and you'll see all of our information there. You can become a member of traillink.com. That's our trail finding app. And we have downloadable maps and resources for the Great American Rail Trail specifically on there. And really what we want to have people do is go out on the trails and talk about it, post about it on social media. Donate if you can to us and to the local groups who are building these trails. All of that, talk about it to your local elected officials. If you live on this route, fantastic, talk about it. If you don't even, we still want the trail movement to grow because I think the rising tide lifts all the boats here.
Absolutely. Well. Kevin Bell, Amanda Cooley, thank you for all the work you all have done on making Rails to Trails and the Great American Rail Trail reality. And thanks for spreading the word on Bike Talk. We will talk about it more here and try to get this summer people out on their bikes riding on some of the trail.
Thanks for having us, Taylor.
Such a pleasure. Happy trails.
You know, I would love to ride across that trail, across the whole country. I mean, what a blast.
Yeah. So our next interview is by an Eco Village volunteer named Ava Maria with Jimmy Lozama, who started the Bike Kitchen in Los Angeles.
Right.
Hello, welcome to Bike Talk Radio. I am guest host Ava Maria, here to interview Jimmy, the founder of the nonprofit organization Reciclos.
Hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good, nice to meet you.
You too. All
right. Okay, let's dive in. Bikes are a core aspect in your daily life. How old were you when you first learned how to ride a bike?
Oh, boy, let me see. I would say that at first glance for me, the bicycle experience, it was very rooted in transportation from the very beginning. And it was always about having the ability to get around in a way that was, for me, empowering. And for me, it was a way that I didn't have to rely on certain systems, definitely car being one of them, because there's a lot of barriers to owning a car, a lot of barriers to having to run a car, and there's obviously a lot of damages that happen in car. Managing a car in your life is something, for me, it feels like managing an elephant in your life. You gotta like, you gotta feed it, you gotta store it, you gotta do all these things to have it. And that wasn't something I wanted to worry about. Now, while I love public trans, even then it was not quite as reliable as it needed to be for LA, for it to become a very reliable, but also like a comfortable way to get around, right? There was always the threat of like having to wait a long time, missing your bus, the bus never coming. On top of that, the built environment around bus shelters and bus facilities also weren't good. If it's hot, you don't really have anywhere to sit. If it's raining, you definitely don't have any coverage. Not all the places you wait for a bus are made equal. So all those systems made it that I didn't really want to engage so much. It wasn't as fun for me. So once I found the bicycle, it became a very independent way to get around on my own two legs without needing much money at all to make it happen. And it was filled with joy. So that transformed my perception of how that translated into me and my own personal mobility. The eco aspect of bicycles didn't come in until a little bit later as I started to hang out with activists and started to see the global damages that car culture brings to the world, definitely to LA. So that's when I started to really open my eyes around, wow, this is not just fun transportation. This is a deep dive into energy equity in our world. And the bicycle is one of the best formats to bring equity into mobility.
That is so great. And you're right. Bicycles are a wonderful way to be eco-friendly, and they are something that most people can use and utilize. Reciclus is a program that's been around for almost 10 years. How did it begin?
Yeah, so I was recently asked how Reciclus began, and it was a funny transition that I had forgotten, really, its roots. The roots of Reciclus are definitely tied in to my son being born. That's when the project to me really started, because when I was 35 years old, that's when my son was born. And even at that point, obviously, I've never had a car. I never relied on a car to get around. I was on a bicycle, but getting a kid around on a bicycle in most formats is not all that easy. At least here, the way we've seen it in LA, you see folks putting their kids in really awkward situations, or even in a little funny little bike trailer, which I'm not crazy about. And so I started thinking about like, how am I gonna be mobile with my kid? And I wanted to definitely be out there with my kid. I wanna like isolate my kid at home just because I don't have a f-ing car. So I started thinking about those options, and that's when I bumped into cargo bikes, specifically the Bock Feets, or the Box Bike as they're called. And the Box Bike was this wonderful amplification. The Box Bike, it all of a sudden seemed to amplify the power of the bicycle itself. Like it made it like an ant, as in it amplified its power. It could carry so much more. So I went to actually a good friend of mine now, Ant Bike Mike by chance, and he was a frame builder for a long time. He's retired now, and he ran Ant, which is Alternative Needs Transportation, which is a small builder. Doing beautiful, like old school kind of roadster bicycles. And I didn't realize that he had a frame building class. So once I saw that he had a frame building class, I decided to go out there and learn how to frame build, but just learn what it takes to frame build, really is what I learned. And it was a lot, but when I came back, I was like, okay, I can see what I need to be able to build cargo bicycles. The project with Reciclus is real specific. It's like, when you are a frame builder, by and large, you're selling bicycles at quite a premium, right? Because it takes a lot of time, a lot of work to build a bicycle by hand. So you have a very boutique-y experience, and you're charging $2,500 and a lot more than that too for a complete bike, if not just a frame and fork alone. So that makes it that if you're frame building, your clientele is a very short range, a very narrow range of people you can actually work with. Now those people are going to be oftentimes folks who have the privilege to have the economy to be able to invest in this very expensive bicycle that's being handmade for them. So that leaves out a whole bunch of people. So when I went to frame building school, I was learning more about this exchange that happens inside of the boutique-y experience with bicycle frame building. And I wasn't into it, and I'm still not into it, in terms of like who we can reach and who has access to bicycles that are needed, right? Not only that, but like, if you're building a bicycle for transportation in that format, and you've got a $5,000 bicycle with you, all of a sudden you're kind of undoing a lot of the utility of a bicycle, because you can't leave it locked up, because we live in a society of inequity. So your fancy stuff will be at risk of being stolen because of inequity. So in a way, they kind of cancel each other out. All of a sudden, you're no longer riding your fancy bike for transportation. You're riding your bicycle mostly for recreation and hopefully finding somewhere it can be right next to you because you value it so much. So I didn't want that to happen. I didn't want to build bikes like that at all. I need to have bicycles that were actually accessible and weren't so precious that you couldn't actually use them for transportation and leave them locked out somewhere, because that's where we live in society in America. So with that, I started thinking about how you can build a cargo bike in a much more inexpensive and accessible way. Obviously, I recycle everything that I can, so that's part of my lingo, my language. But there was a guy out in Oregon going by Tom's Cargo Bicycles, if I recall correctly, Tom's Cargo Bicycles. And he was mating BMX bikes and old mountain bikes and making these beautiful, freakish cargo bikes out of recycled materials. And I'm like, he's got it. That's a wonderful approach, because you're recycling and you're making cargo bikes here domestically out of recycled materials. It's awesome. So he posted his design and I looked at it and I kind of kept on trying to inform myself and get my skill level up to be able to build. Now, inside of that game, you do get to the place where you might want to sell that cargo bicycle, even though it's recycled. And even then it's really expensive, because you got to spend so much time to be able to build a cargo bicycle with any material, right? So you've got the shop space, you've got the materials, you've got just a lot of labor you put into it. If you go into the bicycle business, you get back into the same game of having to sell things for a lot of money to be able to make a living yourself. It's really, really unfair for the bicycle business, because all of a sudden you are excluding a whole bunch of other people who need it. Folks who can actually use bicycles as mobility, whether they're cargo bikes or regular bicycles. And so this is really kind of like deep-seated inequity inside even the bicycle industry. And it's not by design, it's just like, it's capitalism working. And so, I didn't want to play that game. And so what I finally kind of ended up concocting was that education would be the avenue with which we could possibly start to create cargo bicycles that were affordable. Just finding funding, resources that can help us have an educational component, and finding people who may not be able to afford cargo bicycles and getting them out there into the community. And that was going to be the best way. Always recycling, always educating, always trying not to play the for-profit game, because that's always going to exclude too many people who actually need this format of transportation. And that was like the birth of Reciclos, my own personal experience of carrying my kid all over LA on a cargo bike and how beautiful that was, and not being beholden to car systems or public transit systems, but my own human power to get around was awesome. I want that for everybody, obviously. And to note, back in 2022, my son and I took a trip to Denmark, to Copenhagen, all through Scandinavia, just to like land eyes on a society that's already doing that. And it's just like, it's always refreshing to see it. I've got my issues with that region of the world for sure around equity, but to see a society that actually does it it's like you can't unsee that, and you come back to LA going, yo, it's not that hard, honestly, and we need to grow up and like start looking at what are actually healthy systems of mobility and what are ones that are literally destroying our planet and literally threatening the existence of our own kind. Like, let's rethink this really, really, really clearly.
Thank you so much. It sounds like you've taken your experience, your ability to learn about making this a more equitable experience for everyone, and then you've turned it into a program of education for the community. That's so important. It's very important work. And I would like to know, what have been the positive outcomes of the Reciclos program?
So one of the easiest positive formats that comes out of Reciclos is community building. We get people in here celebrating, making, educating, sharing knowledge together. I've had a few wonderful people come through the space who are amazing fabricators who've taught me so much, and I've taught them some stuff as well. And it's a wonderful community skill share space that is amplified from what, like, say, the bicycle kitchen is, where the bike kitchen is teaching you bicycle mechanic skills. We do that, but then we also just actually weld bicycles here and weld trailers and weld all kinds of different things. And that really kind of empowers making stuff, right? And that's a beautiful place to be. And I'm very, very happy to be able to be in a space that I can personally do that. I've learned so much in that space. and also been empowered in that space to be able to do the good things. So it's been really wonderful. One of the hardest realities that I've been facing with Reciclos is how much time it takes to make a cargo bicycle, right? It just takes time, and you got to spend a lot of effort, thinking, designing, approaching, messing up, refabricating, and especially when you're working with recycled materials. There's also, when you get raw metal, you know, it's like a cleaner process. When you have painted metal, you gotta like remove that paint. That becomes messy. That becomes something you really gotta consider. And it's it's not always like the healthiest environment to be in, because you're welding. You're welding on metal. You're taking off paint. Like you gotta be protected, and you gotta protect the people that are around you in that process, and protect also the environment as well. So you gotta be as mindful as possible, and have good systems to try to mitigate some of those damages, right? So these have been like major challenges that come with the kind of fabrication that we're building. That said, we're getting really good at that. And one of the hardest things I have to say is this translation around getting funded for what we're doing. Oftentimes, bikes and cargo bikes aren't seen in LA as a real solution to mobility, because the system itself was never made from its get-go as a place you can do that. However, we do live in Southern California, right? And for the most part, it's a wonderful place to ride a bicycle. So we just need to like have the city catch up to that reality of our environment here. In fact, the original story that has helped us kind of move forward was our pilot project with what we call Rosie. Her name is Rosie, the cargo bike, it's a pink cargo bike. And we had a friend who needed a cargo bike to be able to deliver bread to different parts of the city, to farmers markets, because she was baking with a friend. But cargo bikes being so expensive, she couldn't afford $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 for a full-on cargo bicycle. So she came to us, and there was a kid in the neighborhood who was going through some rough times and was in gang prevention and just needed like a hand up in that moment. And he was great. He was 16. I had never seen him even ride a bicycle, but he was enthused. We came in, and over 10 days, we designed, built, fabricated, welded, and painted a cargo bicycle, and that went to our friend. Since then, that cargo bike has gotten an e-motor to be able to make it a little more efficient, and that client has gotten rid of her car. So our student was able to learn all these things, wanted to go to welding school, and just got exposed to the ability to make an effective community. And our community member on the other side was able to do some part of her business, but also just get rid of her car also and have a full life. Like that story exemplifies what we're after. The hardest part right now is being able to multiply that experience. We need warm bodies up in this space. We need funding. We need funding up in the space to be able to get educators in here, fabricators in here, pay them what they're worth, to be able to create more of the opportunity for the local community, students and clients alike. So that's been the hardest part, and that's where we need like more help than anything. We need some funding and some capacity building so we can do that many more times over.
That sounds great. It sounds like a worthy cause, and I want and hope that funding comes through. Hopefully, this will also help get the word out, get it out to the community and to the right people.
Yeah.
So where can people learn about all the programs with Reciclos?
One place people can go to check us out is going to be on our website, which is lareciclos.org. You'll see stuff that we're up to with Reciclos as a project, and also with Bicicrófono as our amplifying vehicle when we go onto the streets. Mostly the best place is going to be Instagram. So if you go to Bicicrófono, Bicicrófono, Bicicrófono on Instagram, that'll be a good place to see us. And then with Reciclos, it's going to be LA_Reciclos, RECICLOS at Instagram. Both those spaces will give you all the information. Here's where I have a very personal stake in it, is that we need to get people who are not awake yet to wake up with us and look at different ways that equity shows up around transportation and mobility, right? And we want to keep going forward as far as the culture will let us until we topple the old culture, which is killing us, and bring a new culture, which will bring prosperity for our life.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much, Jimmy, for being here and speaking with us today. And thank you so much for your hard work.
Yeah. Cool.
I would like to learn how to build a bike. I'd like to learn how to weld a frame.
Yeah, that'd be a good skill.
I'm a decent mechanic. I could do that.
Totally.
If I put my mind to it.
Go down to Eco Village.
I think I can. Yeah.
All right. Well, another good show. You got a bike quote?
I have one. You are one ride away from a good mood. And you know, that's true. When I'm in a crappy mood and I'm depressed, you know, there's a lot of ups and downs in life. And getting on the bike always makes me feel better.
Have some literal ups and downs.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Rather than some emotional ones.
See you next week, Taylor.
Absolutely, Nick. And remember, if you like the show, spread the good word. Like us on social media. You can support us on Patreon. It really helps. And see you next week, Nick. Ride safe.
Ride safe.
Hi, this is Stacy with A Bike Thought. I did a quick search for people who were killed while biking in the past week. Police say things like, she failed to yield to a GMC Yukon. Or Timothy Mark Eaker. In the account, it says, Eaker was not wearing any reflective clothing and had no lights on his bike. But we can't forget what is really the problem. Cars are too big. They're able to go too fast, and the roads are built to speed them along. It's not about what we're wearing. This episode of Bike Talk is sponsored by the law offices of Pocras and De Los Reyes, with offices in Los Angeles and Bakersfield and serving all of Southern California.
And that was Bike Talk. If you have a story, a tip, or a topic, head over to biketalk.org and send us a message. Talk again next week.
Push on a pedal, push on a pedal, get your heart started. Push on a pedal, push it down and up again. Get on your bike, sit on the seat, push your feet on the pedal, and ride it all around, get on your bike, sit on the seat, push your feet on the pedal, and ride it all around. Get yourself a bike.